Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The focus of this archive edition of Radio Curious is a story about Woburn, Massachusetts, a small blue-collar community just north and west of Boston. In the 1970s, some children in Woburn, Massachusetts became sick and died from childhood leukemia, and some adults in Woburn developed rare forms of cancer. All of these people live very close to each other. Their illnesses were traced to two contaminated water wells that provided water to their homes for drinking and bathing. As a result, one of the most complicated personal injury lawsuits was tried in the United States District Court in Boston. Jonathan Haar, our guest in this program, is the author of A Civil Action, a book which tells the horrendous story of the people who became sick and their trial that unfolded in the court in Boston. Everything told in his book actually happened. The times, places, names, and dates are real. I spoke with Jonathan Haar from his home near Boston in November of 1995 and asked him how he came to write this book.
Actually, it was a friend of mine who drew my attention to it. His name is Tracy Kidder. He's a neighbor, and he's a writer as well. He suggested this idea to me, and it came to him via one of the attorneys involved on behalf of the plaintiffs, Charlie Nesson. He's a Harvard law professor who got engaged in the case and found it so engaging that he thought someone ought to write a book about it, and he suggested it to Kidder. Kidder wasn't interested in it, and he suggested it to me. So it came to me in a sort of circuitous way. I have to say that I didn't go into it intending to write an expose about the legal system, or even an examination about how the legal system worked, nor did I go into it with the notion of writing a kind of crusading, polemical book about the environment.
Is that what it is?
Well, I hope not. I went into it. I hope it is what I went into it wanting to write an engaging story about people at work.
It's certainly that, an engaging story the way I see it.
Well, I wanted to write a page turner, a book that would rivet people, and I had when I entered into this, I found the perfect character, Jan Schlickman. He agreed to give me complete access to the case. I wouldn't just sit in the courtroom as a reporter, as any reporter could do, or any observer, but I could come back to his office afterwards and watch him plan for the next day, prepare witnesses.
Why do you think he chose to do that?
It's interesting. People do things for many reasons. I think, first of all, he always said to me, I have nothing to hide. And I think that was incredibly true. It wasn't just the case that he opened up to me, but it was his entire life, to his love life.
That's right. I mean, you describe it.
He was living as a bachelor, and he had quite a few girlfriends. He opened that up to me. I think in part it was he thought that this case was a really important case, that it deserved someone chronicling it. He also thought that for his own ego, I mean, he wanted to be famous. He always said about himself, and he made no bones about it, that he wanted to get rich and famous by doing good. And I think he thought he was doing good in this case, and that it would be worth seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your personal background, I understand that you teach nonfiction writing, and this book almost seems like fiction. It's so incredibly true.
Yeah, there's that. Well, that's, to me, that's very gratifying to hear. I don't see any reason why a writer cannot use the devices of fiction. That is, character drives a narrative, setting scenes and using dialogue to move a story ahead. I was present throughout a lot of this book, so I got to see it happen. And from the standpoint of accuracy, it was me observing it. I didn't want to write a history of a long and complicated lawsuit. I wanted to write something that had the kind of narrative and the texture of fiction, and yet, at the same time, be completely true.
Well, tell us about some of the people, some of your characters in the book.
Well, there was, first of all, Jan Schlickman, who was at the center of it all. And he was the guy who let me in. He was young. He was in his early 30s when he began this case. The case was filed in 1982 in federal district court, and Jan was then 32 years old. And he'd had some success as a lawyer already. He'd done medical malpractice cases, and he'd won some very big verdicts. In fact, one of them was purported to be the largest malpractice verdict in Massachusetts history at the time. He was flamboyant, mm-hmm. to say the least. He liked to live well. He had $1,000 suits. He was he owned a Porsche and a Beacon Hill duplex, and he was extravagant with his money. And just a kind of gregarious, outgoing, charming fellow. He was, I think, you know, a classic product of 60s idealism and 80s greed and acquisitiveness, uh-huh. which he himself acknowledged. His partner, Kevin Conway, on the other hand, was vastly different from them. They were the best of friends, and yet they were complete opposites. Conway yeah. was frugal, and he dressed not intentionally so, but he was kind of shabby. He was short and portly, where Schlickman was tall and lanky. And it was Conway who kept warning Schlickman not to get involved in this case.
Mm-hmm. Did Schlickman ever regret getting involved in it?
He said at one point to me, after 7 years of being in this case, I was with him and one of his other partners, Mark Phillips, and we were walking down the street, and Phillips said to Schlickman, you know, do you regret getting involved in this thing? And he looked at Phillips in astonishment. He said, you know, does the paraplegic regret stepping off the curb the moment the bus came? Of course I regret it.
Yeah.
It took everything out of him. I mean, he sacrificed materially and spiritually for this case. The case for him became a cause, which is what most lawyers are warned not to let happen to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about this case. What is the case about?
The genesis of it occurred in Woburn, Massachusetts, which is a town of about 36,000 people, 12 miles or so north of Boston. And it began essentially began in 1972, January of 72. A woman who lived in the east part of Woburn in a neighborhood called the Pine Street neighborhood, her name was Ann Anderson. Her son, Jimmy, who was 3.5 years old, was diagnosed with leukemia. And at the time, a diagnosis like that was, you know, the chances were 50-50 he would live. And she was enormously distraught at this. She found out from neighbors who came to visit and to offer their condolences that there were several other children in this area in East Woburn in the Pine Street neighborhood, which was a small neighborhood, you know, maybe 250 houses, that there were, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 other cases. In the end, it turned out there were 8 other cases.
All of leukemia.
All of childhood leukemia.
Yeah.
And the extraordinary thing is that leukemia is a fairly rare disease. It happens only in about 4 out of 100,000 children in a given year. When Anne saw this, she became convinced that there was something going on here. That the cause of leukemia is not known. Some believe that it's a viral agent, an infectious agent. Others believe it's simply, you know, happenstance, that something goes wrong in the body and it has no environmental relationship whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Anne became convinced that there was something wrong with the water or the air or something. And she set out on a crusade to chronicle all the cases in Woburn. And by the time she'd finished, it had been called to the attention of the Centers for Disease Control, who came up to investigate. And the centers, along with the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, concluded that there was indeed a cluster of leukemia, very unusual occurrence, high occurrence of leukemia in this town. At the same time, the wells, the two wells that supplied drinking water to the east part of Woburn, were found contaminated with toxins, industrial solvents. One of them is trichloroethylene, known as TCE. It was found in the largest amount in the wells.
What is TCE? How's it used? Why do we have access to it?
It's a very common, ubiquitous solvent used by industry for degreasing purposes. for example, to wipe a film of oil off of a piece of machine metal, they use TCE. And it was widely used throughout the 40s, 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. It is not so widely used anymore because it's a very toxic substance. It causes cardiological problems, it causes neurological problems, it causes blood problems, which is associated with leukemia.
Mm-hmm.
And one estimate by the EPA, for example, says that as much as 34% of groundwater supplies in the U.S. are contaminated with this substance.
Contaminated to the extent that they were in Woburn?
Woburn was a rather high level of contamination, up to 400 parts per billion, which isn't as high as you get in the workplace, but it's for drinking water. It's to be exposed to it every day, it's quite significant. Woburn, there are places in the United States that are contaminated to a much higher degree than that even, but I think largely it's lesser amounts than that, but still significant amounts.
Mm-hmm. You also mention in the book the contamination that came from using the water for bathing, where it would become steam in the shower and people would breathe it. Was that thought to be a significant effect?
Well, yeah, it was. It was a discovery that Schlickman made with the help of some of the cast of expert witnesses he'd hired. He presumed initially that the contamination had come from drinking the water, consuming it, you know, ingesting it. And as I said, it's, you know, 400 parts per billion is a fairly small amount. You wouldn't necessarily notice it if you were to drink it. And in the workplace, they measure the exposure to in parts per million, not billion. So the exposures in the workplace are significantly higher. A lot of people didn't believe that exposure, just drinking water that had 400 parts per billion of TCE in it, would cause harm. What Schlickman found, though, was that it's not just drinking it. You turn on a shower, and hot water comes out of the shower at 15 gallons a minute, and you take a 10-minute shower.
Mm-hmm.
E is highly volatile, and it off gases. It comes out of the water as a gas, as a vapor.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the shower inhaling this stuff, so you're having, you know, whereas a person might drink a liter of water a day, or 2 liters for an adult, you're having an immense amount of exposure through showering.
Mm-hmm.
It also enters the body through the skin. It's fat soluble. It degreases.
Mm-hmm. It degreases the grease in our skin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Parches people's skin. Workers, when they're exposed to it, when they use it, talk about how their hands turn white and crack.
So how did this chemical get into the water in Woburn?
Well, as it usually does most other places, as it turns out, there were two large corporations which had plants close to the wells in Woburn. One of them, W.R. Grace, had a small machine-making plant, and as I say, TCE is classically used to degrease machined parts. And the employees there, that plant had no policy whatsoever for dumping their waste, and the employees would simply take it out in the backyard and dump it into a ditch.
And from there it leached on into the waterways.
The groundwater, the Grace plant was on a promontory above the wells, and it would flow directly down with the groundwater towards the wells.
Mm-hmm. And eventually we had litigation in the United States District Court in Boston.
That's right. The trial began in March 1986, lasted until July, till the end of July. There was a verdict by six jurors. It was a long and contentious trial. It took far longer than anyone had expected. My job when I started working on this book was to sit in the courtroom and watch what happened and then go back with Schlickman to his office. And for me, it was a fascinating glimpse into the mechanics of our legal system.
I want you to tell us about that, but first I want to say that my guest this week is Jonathan Haar, the author of a new book called A Civil Action that is published by Random House and talks about an incredible lawsuit that occurred in Boston, Massachusetts, resulting from polluted drinking water. You're listening to Radio Curious, and my name is Barry Vogel. Jonathan, how did you see that trial evolve? Was it a battle between some people with limited means who lived in Woburn against huge corporations with a flamboyant, a talented lawyer on their side and enormous law firms on the other side?
Well, that's exactly what it was. It was a kind of classic David and Goliath story. You had Schlickman with his small firm. He had two partners, and several friends were helping out, had an interest in the case. They were good friends of his, and they decided they wanted to help him out. So you had this fairly small firm representing eight families who filed suit. Each of these families had a child with leukemia. In one case, it was an adult with leukemia. You had the small firm going up against W.R. Grace and Beatrice Foods with limitless resources. They were deep pockets. They were, you know, from a plaintiff's standpoint, ideal defendants. But their resources were such that they could hire the best and the brightest, and that's exactly what they did. They hired, Beatrice Foods hired Hale & Dorr, and the chief of litigation for Hale & Dorr,
mm-hmm.
a wise, crafty, vastly experienced trial lawyer named Jerry Fasher, represented Beatrice Foods.
Mm-hmm.
The other side, W.R. Grace, hired Foley, Hoag, and Elliott, a very talented group of people, law firm that kind of specialized and had a reputation for being academic and having a lot of Harvard law graduates on its staff.
So is this a commentary on what happens when little people, if you will, are harmed and they're up against the giant?
Well, that's what the story is. You know, I hope that people derive from it what they will. I wasn't polemical about it. I think that in one sense our legal system is quite wonderful in that there's not many places in the world where people with a complaint like this could find a lawyer and get access to the system. I mean, it's people deride and bewail and get angry about contingency fee lawyers, but they enabled the people of Woburn, who had essentially no resources, they were working class people, to get into the legal system and to get
mm-hmm.
their case heard.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that's a remarkable facet, I think, of our system. There aren't too many lawyers, of course, who would take on a case like this. It was huge. The proof problems were exceedingly difficult, and it was a long, long time and required enormous financial resources.
That all came from Jan Schlickman, who ended up bankrupt.
Yeah, he ended up, he spent everything he had on the case.
Yeah.
And he won after a fashion.
Mm-hmm.
He won against W.R. Grace, got a significant sum of money from them.
I think it's important to mention again that this is a true story, that this is not fiction. And in doing that, you use the real names of all of the characters. How do they feel about that now that the book is out?
It's interesting. Jan Schlickman couldn't be happier.
Right.
That this story got told. That's, you know, it's what he'd hoped for from the beginning. It took me a long time to actually figure out how to tell it, and in the telling, it took a long time. But he's a very happy man at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, I've spoken with everyone. I've seen everyone who I've written about, with the exception of some of the smaller, more minor roles, characters in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I have good relationships with all of them. And considering how incredibly adversarial and bitter this case was, and how much the lawyers ended up disliking each other personally.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I'm pleased that, you know, I got to know them and that they think that their depiction of them is fair. I spent, for example, with Jerry Fasher. I attended his Harvard Law School class and his trial practice class.
Yes.
For 2 years running, and he and I would go out afterwards and have dinner at the Harvard Law School cafeteria.
And this was while you were working on the book?
Yes. It was, this was part of my research. I'd take notes. We would talk about, you know, this case and his life and the practice of law. And, you know, my hope was to depict him, to depict everyone in the book as three-dimensional characters, not as, you know, these paper thin kind of characters that you find in third-rate fiction, you know, the mm-hmm. evil guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you could read a little portion of the book and give us some of that flavor.
Sure. I'll start here at the beginning of the book with Schlickman. We meet him very early in the book. The lawyer, Jan Schlickman, was awakened by a telephone at 8:30 on a Saturday morning in mid-July. He had slept only a few hours, and fitfully at that. When the phone rang, he was dreaming about a young woman who worked in the accounting department of a Boston insurance firm. The woman had somber brown eyes, a clear complexion, and dark shoulder-length hair. Every working day for the past 5 months, the woman had sat across from Schlickman in the courtroom, no more than 10 feet away. In 5 months, Schlickman had not uttered a single word directly to her, nor she to him. He had heard her voice once, the first time he'd seen her, but he could no longer remember what it sounded like. When their eyes had happened to meet, each had been careful to convey nothing of import, to make the gaze neutral and to shift it away as quickly as possible without causing insult. The woman was a juror. Schlickman hoped that she liked and trusted him. He wanted desperately to know what she was thinking. In his dream, he stood with her in a dense forest, overgrown with branches and roots and vines. Behind the woman were several people whose faces Schlickman recognized, the other jurors. The woman was trying to decide which path in the forest to take, and Schlickman was attempting to point the direction. He beseeched her. She remained undecided, a dream of obvious significance, and unresolved when the phone rang and Schlickman awoke, enveloped by a sense of dread. The man on the phone identified himself as an officer at Bay Bank South Shore, where Schlickman had an automobile loan that was several months in arrears. Unless Schlickman was prepared to pay the amount due, it came to $9,203. The bank intended to repossess the car, a black Porsche 928. Schlickman had no idea whether or not Bay Bank South Shore had been paid in the last several months, but on reflection, he felt pretty certain it had not. He told the banker to speak with a man named James Gordon. "He handles my financial affairs," said Schlickman, who gave the banker Gordon's phone number and then hung up.
Gordon, go ahead.
Schlickman was still in bed 20 minutes later when the phone rang again. This time the voice on the other end identified himself as the Suffolk County Sheriff. The sheriff said he was at a payphone on Charles Street, 2 blocks from Schlickman's building. He had come to repossess the Porsche. "I want you to show me where the car is," said the sheriff. Schlickman asked the sheriff to wait for 10 minutes. Then he tried to call Gordon. There was no answer. He lay in bed and stared at the ceiling. Again the phone rang. "Are you going to show me where the car is?" asked the sheriff. "I think I will," said Schlickman. So that's an introduction to Schlickman, who's about to lose his Porsche. And
this is still during the course of the trial?
This was actually the jury was out. The jury took 2 weeks to bring back a decision. And this was in the second weekend. Schlickman lost his Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
He was on foot from then. He walked from his Beacon Hill duplex, which he later lost, down to the courthouse. He ended up living out of his office. He essentially had become homeless. He was living out of his office, sleeping on a fold-out couch, mm-hmm. eating out of cans of tuna fish.
Wow.
And still pursuing the case, still pursuing the appeal against Beatrice.
Jonathan, the title of your book, A Civil Action, is that a comment on what the book is about?
Well, I spent a long time looking for titles. I thought out of 50,000 pages of transcripts and depositions and briefs, I would find something that would leap out at me. In effect, you know, the title says exactly what the book is about. This is a civil case, a civil action. I also had hoped that, although the reader can't know it until he reads the book, that there's a hint of irony in it, because if anything, it was
anything
uncivil.
But civil. Yeah, that's what I thought. And I understand that Disney has plans to make a movie out of this story.
That's right. Robert Redford bought the rights, film rights to the book last March. To me, it was absolutely amazing. I had no notion that you know, anybody would want to make a movie mm-hmm. out of this, but in mm-hmm. fact, it was a quite a bidding war.
Is there a date when we might look for it on the screen?
I don't know that exactly. They have a screenwriter named Steve Zalian, who mm-hmm. wrote Schindler, won an Oscar for writing the screenplay mm-hmm. to Schindler's List, is at work on it, and he thinks he gave himself 6 months. He thinks mm-hmm. he'll be done in 4 months by January with the first draft. So he's hard at work, and he thinks it's coming along well.
Will you have any role in overseeing that draft?
No, I think that Steve will probably show it to me simply out of courtesy. I met him when I was in Los Angeles, and we had a wonderful time walking along the beach in Malibu.
I wondered if you're working on any other books.
I have, not yet. I'm actually on a book tour for this book at the point. I have a story due at the New Yorker about the crash of an airplane, U.S. Air Flight 427 in Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
That's my next project. I've spent some time on it already. I have several book ideas in mind. But in writing this kind of book, the problem is, and the challenge is, to get access. People have to agree to want to be followed around.
Sure. Well, Jonathan Haar, we're coming to the end of our time, but I want to ask you the question that I like to ask all guests at the end of an interview, and that is, could you tell us about another interesting book that you've read lately?
Another interesting book that I've read lately. I actually haven't had a chance to read a lot of books. And what I spent, actually, it's interesting, what I spent my time reading while I was working on this was old books, was Charles Dickens. I think some of my characters are Dickensian in a way, and maybe Dickens influenced me. But that's actually what I've been reading most of.
And you draw those characters in to paint the picture of who these people are.
Yeah. That's, you know, making a character come to life on the page. That's the real challenge that I see as a writer.
Well, you describe their dress. For Jerry Fasher, you describe his cats at his home where he lives as a bachelor.
Yeah. The way, I mean, this guy, Jerry Fasher, was a fellow who, chief of litigation at Hill & Dorr, you know, made a lot of money, and yet he was an incredibly frugal man who dressed in shirts that had stains from pens on them, and it was just, you know, he was a Dickensian character. I didn't have to rely on Dickens to draw a portrait of Jerry Fasher.
Yeah. Jonathan Haar, I want to thank you very much for joining us here at Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Jonathan Haar is the author of A Civil Action, and the books that he recommends are the works of Charles Dickens. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.